Hello.
Hey.
Hi. How you doing?
How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm very good.
Wonderful. So you're in New York at the moment?
Mm-hmm.
How are you doing with the lockdown?
Just fine. Everything is weird. Hmm. Everything is very eerie and quiet. Are you in London?
No, I'm in a tiny little village in the south of England.
Okay.
So it's sort of, if you'd seen like the Durrells or like, you won't have seen that. It's sort of the rural version of Downton Abbey.
I've seen Hot Fuzz.
Perfect. That is like 20 minutes away from me. That's filmed in Wales. That is.
Does that count?
Oh, absolutely. It is very Hot Fuzz territory.
Amazing.
And
that's great.
Do you think you look like Gabe?
Do you think I do?
Yes.
Okay. Because that was the first thing we said to each other. Was because I was waiting for another show, and he said, oh, we kind of look alike. And
I was about to be like, are you just friends because you look the same?
exclusively just, this is what I'm looking for. And that is
absolutely.
How I can, sort of like Orphan Black, but of the New York comedy scene.
I know, my only friends have birthmarks.
I'm sure.
So we're not friends, we're acquaintances.
Yeah, I'll just cut that and have that as the trailer.
Perfect.
The whole episode. I'll hang up now and we're...
Right.
Cool, okay, well, we'll kick off. Hello and welcome to Spieling the Beans with me, Dom Stevens, the storytelling podcast in which storytellers tell stories about telling stories. My guest this week is a writer for The Tonight Show starring Jimmy Fallon, a two-time national speech champion, a former corporate speechwriter for Target, and a stand-up from Minnesota. Speaking transatlantically one Friday morning in April, we discussed why The Tonight Show is uniquely tailored for socially distanced writing, how to characterize Minnesotan comedy compared to that of New York and Chicago, the impact both Judd Apatow and Eddie Izzard have had on the narrative nature of comedy, what forensicating is, how speech and debate relates to stand-up, the comfort of being alone on a stage, an impromptu deep dive into rhetorical analysis on the concept of rhetoric itself, and much, much more. So, let's get straight to it. Please welcome my guest for this week, ladies and gentlemen, Chloe Radcliffe. Well, Radcliffe, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you so much for having me. And thank you for calling me Radcliffe.
You're so welcome.
I love being called Radcliffe.
Well, I've done my research, and I heard that you're desperately trying to get your Fallon colleagues to start calling you Radcliffe.
Try.
And why not? I can only assume Jimmy will be listening to this. I can't see why he wouldn't.
There's nothing else to do.
Exactly. So why not just get the ball rolling on that?
Well, I appreciate it.
You're welcome. Is the Zoom helping that in terms of you can choose that Radcliffe as your username?
Oh, I suppose I could. It didn't stick. If it didn't stick in the first 3 months, it's not going to stick because of Zoom. That's the attitude that I've taken. I think I never get called Radcliffe because I'm not a Radcliffe. I'm not, I mean, I want to be, but I'm really not, unfortunately.
just force the issue, maybe a couple more months, it'll...
Thank you. I appreciate the belief.
Yeah, anytime. How is it writing a late night show over the internet as opposed to being in 30 Rock?
That's a good question. It is more chaotic. Also, a lot of the chaos individuals don't see. So, like, I had a minor screw up a couple weeks ago that I really internalized and felt very bad about. And then I talked to one of our coordinating producers, who's like the guardian angel of the show. And she was like, oh, there have been so many fuck ups. Nobody has noticed yours. Or like people noticed because it was a fuck up, but don't internalize it. It's not a big deal. It's chaos.
Wow.
So I think we're now sort of settling in. Maybe I'm selling ourselves out. We're now settling into the systems a little bit more, and I think it's a lot less chaotic. But it is just, it's weird. You know, so much of the show, we would just run down to somebody's office and poke our head in and ask. That said, The Tonight Show is unique Well, it's not unique from all other late nights, but it is unique from many writers' rooms in that there is not a writers' room. Everybody has, I share an office with two other writers, and the show is so fast paced. There's a bunch of factors that all lead to, there's not a lot of like sitting down as a group of writers and just like bouncing ideas off of each other. And I think that is more true of The Tonight Show than of many other shows from what I can gather. So because of that, we sort of were already suited to quarantine because it's not like, nobody's saying, man, I miss throwing a ping pong ball at the wall and eating yogurt with you guys. Like that's not, you know, there wasn't that to begin with. So it's not, it has been, I don't know about an easier transition than anybody else, but it has not felt that wildly different in many respects.
But that's very good. It's good you were so isolated beforehand.
Yeah, right. What a silver lining.
So what was your first memory of late night watching it growing up?
That's a great question. I think my first memory is staying up to watch the top 10 lists on Letterman.
Sure.
Yes, I think my first memory of late night is the top 10 lists. I had the Late Show or Letterman himself, I'm not sure, put out I bet I still have them. Wait, I do. Wait. Top 10 list books.
Oh, cool.
That's so funny. It's very funny because I don't think of myself as somebody who, like, who had a lot of exposure to comedy writing as a kid. And I don't mean like I like watched movies, but and my mom watched Letterman. But I wasn't like, I didn't grow up thinking that I would be a comedy writer. I grew up thinking I would be an actor forever and ever and ever. And I just like, I knew that writing for TV was a career, but that didn't really interest me. I don't think I really understood that writing comedy could be a different branch of that path. I just like, so many people around me, and that's true for stand-up too, so many people around me have these stories of like, I would, when my parents were fighting, I would put on Comedy Central's half hours and I would watch them under my covers and it was my only relief, and I spent my entire childhood wishing to be a stand-up, and I was like, Jesus Christ, like, I do not, I have nothing like that. I have no exposure to that. So it's like, I mean, as recently as, maybe I shouldn't be saying this, does anybody watch? tell me you don't have very many people watching. As recently as like, I think it was a year ago, roughly a year ago, I wrote a list of like what I want in comedy and hand wrote a note on that list after I made the list. Note, late night writing is not on this list. As like a, because I was doing a bunch of packets, and I still clearly did packets, and I'm thrilled to be writing for the show now. Don't fire me.
Get that bit in.
But I have always come from a performance standpoint, and that's always been where I've been rooted. And so I just, and that coupled with like, I didn't grow up with a ton of exposure to stand up. I would watch a little bit, and I always felt like, I don't get it. It's not for me. So I think that like the world of comedy just wasn't a huge exposure. So it's funny actually that I have these books and love these books. They're dog-eared. I don't know if you can see. There's like, can you see that a bunch of pages are, I don't know if you can see.
Yeah, no, I can. I can.
A bunch of them are dog-eared as just like, here are my favorites that I would go back and reread. It's very funny looking back now to be like, oh yeah, I guess I did have interest in this kind of joke writing, and I just didn't ever have any exposure to it being a real life, a real world possibility.
That seems crazy. I had this sort of similar thing in terms of having those kind of, but not those two, but if you could see the bookshelves over the side, they're stacked with various sort of like Steve Martin, like Frasier scripts, Judd Apatow, these kind of ones. But always with like the, oh, this is like, this is Camelot. This is a phenomenal wonderland. And so for you to do that sort of inadvertently and have that as a sort of narrative thread through your younger years and not realise that is amazing. I was going to ask, were you a TV kid? Because you do an amazing piece in your stand-up about... It's better if you explain than I explain to you your own stand-up routine. But the countdown from 5 to 1.
Oh, that's funny. Yes, I... It's in a larger bit about not being popular in high school. And I tell a story of that every day, and this is 100% true, every day I would buy 2 cookies in the cafeteria, and we had a microwave in the middle of the cafeteria, and I would put them in, and then, and how I say it in the bit is, out loud in the middle of my peers, I would say, and you're on in 5, 4, 3,
you're on the air.
And then I would go and eat my cookies by myself. So you're asking, was I a TV kid because of that reference?
Well, bizarrely, not only did I do that kind of stuff when I was the same age as you then, I do that now as a primary school teacher to control the class. I say, you're going live, you need to be silent on 1, and 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
That's funny. That's great.
And that's purely because I was obsessed with TV stuff when younger. So did that come from you watching a lot of TV? Where did that...
It's very funny. I think I have an answer to the 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, but the TV question in general, I don't think of... I watched a lot of TV when I was young, when I was sort of like preteen-ish. And then by high school, I wasn't really watching TV anymore. But like, I watched a ton of Nickelodeon. So I watched like Rugrats and SpongeBob and Rocket Power. Like, I watched a lot of like kids cartoon show. I mean, that it was age appropriate. It wasn't crazy, but again, it's like, I'm surrounded by these people who are like, I've watched every episode of Seinfeld because it was my comedy education. And I'm like, I don't know. As a kid, I watched Seinfeld and was like, I don't get it. And now, of course, Seinfeld is very funny, but like, I feel like I'm surrounded by these people who like understood comedy way earlier than I did. And I feel a little ashamed of that, but whatever, it's fine. The 5, 4, 3, 2, 1 thing is, I mean, my closest explanation for why I did that or why it was in my head, you know, when you have like an old PC keyboard where the keys are really big.
Sure.
And when there's a separate number pad, I don't know if you have this experience, but since as young as I can remember, I loved hitting those buttons, like the like tactile feel of the keyboard response is so satisfying. Mm-hmm. And especially on that number pad, I remember being at a garage sale when I'm sure I was younger than 10 and standing in front of a keypad like that, in front of the numbers, and just like just tapping a bunch of numbers and acting as if I'm like, I'm the, you know, like, yes. Uh-huh. And like, I would in movies and TVs, when people would be like, when people could like type a number in without looking at, I don't know why that like number keypad, it was always very satisfying and fascinating to me. And I was always like, I want a job where I can type numbers on a number keypad. And the 5, 4, 3, 2, 1 thing to me, the closest I can get to explaining it is that it is sort of in the same world of satisfying.
And numerical.
And numerical. And I was a math major in university. Maybe that has to do with it. It's the same level of like satisfying. It's not, it had nothing to do with me. It's like there's like a power to it. There's like a power to typing in the numbers, and there's a power to saying, and like I get to call 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. It's not because I sat around being like, one day I'll be a director. Not at all. And I don't mean to shit on those people. I'm like, where was I? What was I doing? I was playing with Barbies. Like, I don't know why you guys were like developing your comedic palette. I have no idea. What the fuck was I doing? Anyway.
So they've spent their whole lifetime curing over scripts and highlighting and going, okay, there's got to be a way of cracking this.
Right.
You then stroll into the office going, I thought I'd pick it up on a whim and now I'm here.
Yeah, I guess so. And I think that has been a hurdle at this job is that this is my first writing job, and I haven't spent a lifetime culturing that skill or even that familiarity or even the like cultural references. So my first month, at least, maybe more, was like just building the muscle, was just building the skill of like, oh yes, how do you come up with a bit idea for somebody? How do you like, and my stand-up, from you've seen my stand-up apparently, is not observational, and that doesn't mean that I don't make observations, but it's not Seinfeld, you know, like here's a thing about modern life. It's much more personal. And so then I didn't really have any practice writing observational humor until this. And that doesn't mean that I can't do it, but it just like in terms of this is a skill that you do constantly, I hadn't been exposed to that. So that was like there was a steep learning curve.
And yet you spent a decade as a, I want to get this right, forensicator?
Correct.
So there's the rhetoric involved in that, the timing of the joke, the making sure it lands and hits. Although it's not been Seinfeld-based, it's been decades of curation of all the skill sets and talents involved.
Yes. The practice of writing for myself, of editing my own, and I have always applied this to stand-up, but you're right that it applies to late night as well. The practice of editing my own writing and having to get rid of something even if I like it, writing under a deadline, of writing to a formula, all of that, I am practiced in, which I think is why your comment about I'll just pick it up on a whim and waltz in and then get a job or whatever.
Which I did not mean. I did not mean that sincerely whatsoever.
Well, but what's funny is, I mean, right? Truth in comedy. I do have a fairly accelerated timeline in terms of a comedy career at this point. Knock on wood. Hopefully that continues. I haven't hit 5 years officially since my first. I'm about to hit 5 years at the end of May, Memorial Day weekend, since my first stand-up open mic. So I am aware of what an accelerated timeline that is, and I credit 100% of that accelerated timeline to speech, to forensics, because it was so many corollary skills. The core of how to be funny and how to write funny jokes, I didn't have that exposure to, other than whatever raw crackling stuff was inside, but all of the corollaries, everything from editing your own writing to how to write an email to somebody in the industry and be professional and be appropriate, you know, like everything, I had 10 years of training in.
Yeah, and phenomenal testament to natural ability and be able to rightfully be at such a top show so early on.
And thank you. And I want to say that, like, I don't mean, because I frequently have people say when I explain, I think 10 years of speech is what got me here. Mm. People are like, yeah, and also you're talented. And I'm like, sure. But what I'm saying is that if I didn't have that 10 years of speech, I might have gotten here. I'm sure I would still get to the places that I am, but it would have taken maybe 15 years or probably less. But like, I would have had to still do all of that training that I happen to do in speech in comedy, and it would have taken a lot longer.
Yes, and the anecdote of being a two-time national champion coming up in the interview for Tonight Show, clinching the deal, potentially.
Who knows? Yes, right. Hopefully.
So what is it like walking into 30 Rock on the first day? Is it full of people where you go, oh, it's the person from the television, or is it sort of, do you get a lot of fear, do you get a lot of, what is it? That's a terribly phrased question.
You're asking about the first day.
I am.
It's funny, I took the subway in. I usually bike everywhere in New York. Biking is my main form of transportation, but that for, I told myself that for that first week I would take the subway because I just wanted to, whatever. I wanted to not have to deal with being sweaty and changing and et cetera, et cetera.
Sure.
So I took the subway in, and of course the New York, you know, I'm going in at 8 a.m. or whatever, and it's packed and silent. Nope. You know, nobody's talking, nobody wants to talk, whatever. And I, was so like buzzed with excitement that I texted my boyfriend and then I think another friend. I was like, I'm so excited that I want to like make an announcement on the subway. I want to be like, excuse me, everybody. I just want to let you know today is my first day writing for the Tonight Show with Jimmy Fallon. Maybe you've heard of it. And all of my friends, of course, laughed and were like, you fucking idiot. You know, people would, who knows what would happen, but it might get violent.
Either violence or like violent applause.
I can't imagine that it would go in the applause direction.
Film musical number.
Yeah. And then, yeah, I mean, so it was surreal that first day. The one thing is that I did the NBC Late Night Writers Program, and that is also in 30 Rock. It's in a different floor, in a different tower, in a whatever. It must have been in the same building and just in a different, on a different floor. So I had the experience, which also was helpful that first day of like, I know what door to walk in.
Sure.
Because 30 Rock is a huge office building. And yes, it has SNL and Myers and Fallon, but it has all of MSNBC and NBC and all, I mean, it has Rachel Maddow and it has whatever, you know, so it has all these like crazy famous people, but then it also has like the people who do accounting for Tanked, the Animal Planet show about aquariums or whatever fuck, you know? So it's like, you're not surrounded by famous people. The floor of the Tonight Show is can get sort of nuts like that, but and SNL, I'm sure as well, and Myers, et cetera. But walking into the building is not crazy. And then what were you asking? Then the rest of it, I don't know. Did that answer your question?
It did. It was. I'm not entirely sure what I asked exactly.
Great.
It was a vague stammer that I was going wildly off book. There seems to be a noted difference between comedy in Los Angeles and comedy in New York. From Minnesota and producer of the many years of the 10,000 Laughs, is this right?
Mm-hmm.
How would you encapsulate...
Which maybe doesn't make sense if you don't know that the Minnesota State slogan is Land of 10,000 Lakes.
Yes.
Which is why.
Because it has exactly 11,824 lakes.
Jesus Christ, you did your research.
I've devoted like a full 2 days to this. but yeah, so how would you encapsulate Minnesota comedy versus New York comedy?
That's an interesting question. I think I'll talk about the Minnesota scene.
Sure.
I don't know that this is, well, whatever. So the Minneapolis scene, which is the main city in Minnesota, the biggest city in Minnesota, was very club heavy at a point while I was, for about a year, maybe even 2 years while I was there, there were 6 clubs or rooms that functioned as clubs. And I mean, in any place, that's crazy. Like, does LA have more than 6 clubs? Probably, but like, I can't name more than 6 clubs in LA. New York has, you know, 15 or 20, but it's just a different world. So the fact that Minnesota had so many clubs really shaped and one club in particular, Acme, is the sort of godfather of the scene, for better or for worse. But because of that, most people's stage time was on a club stage. And the DIY indie scene was sort of perpetually on life support. It was the kind of thing where, like, there was always, like, one good indie show and a few bad ones and a few, like, weird dive bar shows that were long-running but weird. But so there's so many scenes. Like, Chicago is very DIY. There's 2 clubs. And like, and it's not one of them offers a lot of stage time to people, but one of them doesn't really offer a lot of stage time to locals. And so Chicago is so DIY, which means that shit gets weird. People do weird stuff. People do characters. People experiment. I mean, it's just like, it really blossoms. And it also means that frequently, I think sort of like if you're painting a very broad picture, Chicago people are very performative and great and funny in this character stuff, but aren't always the like cleanest joke writers. Minneapolis is so clubby and there's very little DIY. And so that meant, and of course you're familiar with the, you know, the like club comedy versus alt comedy. And so when you come up from when you're, you know, your first open mic is at Acme Comedy Club or even the Indie Comedy Club, but it's still a club and that's all of your stage time, then of course the comedy that you write becomes clubbier. So Minneapolis as a whole tends to have strong joke writers, or I'm not super in touch with the scene anymore, but it historically always had strong joke writers and not the most interesting performers, if that makes sense.
It does, yeah. And it does seem that Chicago has a sort of ownership on improv versus other cities. And I think that absolutely falls into the DIY feel of it.
Right, right.
In the most literal sense, I suppose.
Yes, yes, truly.
We mentioned before about forensicating. Mm-hmm. To explain, as I didn't know prior to about 6 hours ago, what is forensicating in your words?
Yes. So forensicating is we don't have to use that word. Speech and debate. It's speech and debate, and the term forensics applies to it for an annoying reason. That has to do with ancient Greek legal settings. And it's not worth going into. So, yes, we're not dead. There's two versions of forensics. There's dead bodies forensics, and then there's speech and debate forensics, and we're that one.
Okay.
So speech and debate, I only competed in speech. I never debated. Debaters are the nerds. And I don't know. I know there's competitive debate in Britain, right?
Massively. Yeah.
Yeah.
The whole governmental system is run on, there's something called British parliamentary style debate.
Exactly.
And they all grow up with this system. And right. So that's why it's so antagonistic and so dissing people, but via the speaker. You can't diss directly, you have to diss via another person.
Right, right, right. And I mean, people, that is a category of debate in American competitions is parliamentary debate.
Oh, okay.
There's several categories and that's one of them. Anyway, that's debate. I don't know if Britain has individual speech competitions. I assume so. It seems very British.
I mean, it's our language after all. I as a teenager was part of very simply the what's called the English Speaking Union. Which is, so there is that element of that, but it was English Speaking Union, but with, it was sort of British parliamentary debate in there. So you'd have a chair. I was the chair in it. There was a speaker, who was from a different team. So, and then a questioner or a vote of thanks who would then question the speaker from another one.
Sure.
And I only did it as I fancied the girl who asked me to do it. And so went for that. But I didn't want to do it anymore, so I just used it as a trial of 15-year-old stand-up comedy, which I thought would just, like, kamikaze it, but I'd still get sort of, like... And we ended up getting to the finals of it. So it's wildly away from your question, but I understand exactly the world that your 10 years were in.
Yes. The individual speech competition in the US is fairly different from that. But that's the world. Speech is, there's a handful, there's about a dozen categories, and it's split into three what I think of as genres. There's a genre that is much more acting-based, so it's interpretation, officially, mm-hmm. where we are, but it's fundamentally doing a 10-minute monologue or a 10-minute compilation of poems or whatever. There's a category where you write your own persuasive, informative, analytical speech. That's sort of a platform speech. And then there's a genre that that is limited preparation. So you flip over a quote and you have a minute and a half to write a 6-minute speech about it. Or you get a question about world events and you have half an hour to put together a 6-minute speech on it, whatever. So that's how speech is broken out in the US. And then you compete in rounds against other people. You know, there's six people in a round and there's a judge and you're in a classroom and everybody gets up and does their speech. And I did that for 10 years.
Fantastic. You hinted at it earlier. How does speech relate to stand-up in terms of having a single narrative voice?
That's a good question about the voice. I'm sort of going back to what I said earlier, but it is more to me about all of the corollary skills. How speech relates to stand-up is more about all of the corollary skills. And I think the voice of it is just the comfort of being alone on a stage, is the sort of like, I am, you know, no matter what, if anybody ever asks me to stand up and give a speech, to talk to, you know, if somebody hands me a microphone in a stadium and says, you need to go out and explain to these 15,000 people, whatever, or, you know, you need to get up at this wedding and say whatever, I like, that will never be undoable for me. And I think that is maybe the voice element that I got from speech, rather than a, because it's not, you know, like when I was writing my own stuff, when I was writing a rhetorical analysis of a website called pimpthisbum.com, and, you know, which is a speech I did, I'm not writing it in my voice. And of course, my writing is different than somebody else's writing, but fundamentally, I'm writing to a formula. Fundamentally, I'm writing down to the sentence. You know, I need a sentence, I need a topic sentence, I need whatever. So it's, does that make sense? That answers the question.
Yeah, totally. And linked to that, you were a corporate speechwriter for several years before entering comedy at Target. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
What kind of speeches did you write? What would you recommend for a speechwriter? What are some rookie mistakes?
That's funny. I don't rookie mistakes. I wasn't familiar with formatting, and even like so far as what our agreed upon grammar guidelines were. And I've always been very good at grammar, but how do you write AM and PM? Some people write them lowercase with dots. Some people write them uppercase without dots. Some people put a space between. Some people don't. So, like, whatever. There's all, and that's just AM or PM. So I think I frequently would just make formatting mistakes, and none of them were huge, and it was fine. But that's like a, it's just like, you know, what are the rules of this world? To keep a lot of big ideas straight, mm-hmm. I have always needed to have those outside my brain. I've never been good at just like having a, which is funny because in some ways I'm very good at having a file of big ideas in my head, but it's in some ways I'm very bad at it. And I don't know I know it when I see it.
Sure.
In this case, I'm good. In this case, I'm bad. But so for example, when I was writing speeches, it was that, you know, if I'm writing for the head of merchandising at Target, which is a big job in a retail enterprise, I had just come from merchandising. I had been hired into merchandising as an analyst, like every, you know, that was a very common sort of business job in Minnesota. And so I had heard all of the big headlines and major stories of like, what are the good stories that we keep telling? And what are the headlines that we're telling our people, whatever. But I just wasn't good at pulling those up immediately unless I really had it in front of me. Mm-hmm. And sort of similarly, it was like, I know what the company's internal strategy is that other people haven't seen, but I have seen because I'm in executive communications. But without that page in front of me of like, what are the five things we need to hit? It wasn't in my brain. I think largely just because I didn't care about it. So, but if I had it on the page in front of me, then of course I could be like, and here's a sentence we could write to address this. And here's where we could plug in this story. And here's whatever. When I have the pieces in front of me, I can very easily be like, oh, this goes here, this goes here, this goes here. Here's how to knit it all together. But without being particularly emotionally invested in the thing, I am not great at keeping it all straight.
Sure. Which it's only human to do. It would be the act of a psychopath to do the opposite.
Well, thank you. And I'm no psychopath.
That is it. Well, that's the trailer there. I'm no psychopath. That's all they need to know.
Perfect.
Do you remember the first laugh you got on stage?
I remember the first set I did. Well, do you mean in stand-up? I mean,
well, either.
I did theater forever since I was a kid, and I always loved getting laughs in theater. I don't remember the first laugh I got in a play or a musical. And I've always been funny. I think my friends would always have described me as funny. And your listeners better.
Yeah, they will.
Yeah, tell me I'm funny. But in terms of stand-up, I remember the first set I did. Mm-hmm. I don't remember exactly what line got a laugh. I remember getting fewer laughs than I expected to. I remember being conscious of going very fast and like getting off stage and being like, well, I really sped through that and I bet I would have gotten a lot more laughs if I had slowed down. But also feeling like that wasn't bad. And like, not only, I think like that wasn't bad no matter what, and it really wasn't bad for a first time doing stand-up.
Yeah, and that must be vital in terms of sustaining it and going, well, I got a really, the first gig went fantastically, therefore
yes,
I'm inherently capable of that, and therefore
yes,
I can replicate it in the future.
Yes, and it, and I think you're exactly right. And even though I would not describe the first gig as having gone fantastically at all, but it was that feeling of, oh, I am completely capable of this. Because it was like, you know, by a minute in, I went, oh, this is exactly like speech. And I had spent so long, I did improv in college, like everyone, and I did, and then I did theater forever and ever. And I always sort of knew that theater people drive me a little nuts. And so theater was never, even though I always thought of myself as an actor, it was never really my, like, here is the thing I want to do for, I always felt a little conflicted about, do I want to be in theater forever? And I think by the end of college, I think by maybe halfway through college, I think I knew sort of implicitly, maybe without admitting it realistically that, or explicitly that, I wouldn't spend my life in theater. Mm-hmm. I was a theater major for a week. I was a double major for a week. And then I was like, I don't want this. And I walked back in a week later and pulled it.
Yeah.
And that was sophomore year probably. And so it's sort of like, I think if I had known, if that had been my thing, I would have known, whatever, the writing was on the wall. And and speech was always my priority above theater and above improv. In terms of performances, speech was always the thing that I would just pour my whole self into and work on constantly. And I spent so much time on speech and was very like, didn't need to motivate. I not that like there weren't days where I didn't want to write my speech, but like it was just very easy to work on it. It was the thing I loved. It was the thing I wanted to do. And I always felt like, there's no grown-up speech. There's grown-up improv. Like as an adult, you can do improv. And there's grown-up theater. You can be in theater. But there's no grown-up speech. There's no, you know, professional speech competitions. And then I did stand up and I went, oh, this is grown-up speech. That's what it is. Mm-hmm. And so it was that feeling of, oh, I am inherently capable and I can keep doing this.
Amazing. You've said before how your speeches where you won particularly strongly was when it started funny and then went serious.
Mm-hmm.
And comedy seems to have taken that trajectory. An earlier episode of the show, Anna Dresden spoke to that about how there seems about 45 minutes in, there's a sudden sort of tragedy that hits the performer and then the show turns. Do you like that? And why do you feel comedy has headed in that direction in the past 10, 15 years or so?
The short answer is I love that. I've said before that that's what, you know, those are my favorite performances. And as to why, man, it's so funny. I'm like, I'm not qualified to answer why. What do you mean me? I don't know. Ask Mr. Apatow. I don't fucking know. I mean, truly, I think part of it is Mr. Apatow. I think he has really sort of put his finger on the scale there. I think there is like a cynical or a transactional perhaps way of looking at it where it is like, well, truly, literally, Judd Apatow made a couple successful movies, made a big name for himself, and then like became godfather of comedy. And also, please, Mr. Apatow, be my godfather.
Absolutely.
But that, like, you know, when one name becomes the name in many ways, and that one name is doing a very specific thing, suddenly everyone does that very specific thing. So I think that, you know, that is maybe a less romantic version of why, but I think that's true. Then maybe to answer the question of like, why would people respond to that? I think it's sort of the, oh, Jesus, it's so funny. I am like, why am I saying this? Like, this is my, sure, this is my opinion, but like, I'm not a TV critic. I'm not, who am I to, whatever. I watched Rugrats and SpongeBob. I don't, what, who am I to comment on this?
You're a writer anyway, on The Tonight Show.
I know, who knows jack shit. Anyway, my opinion, my best guess is that it's sort of the same cultural shift that has moved us into PC culture, and I think PC culture is great. I don't think it is ruining comedy at all. I absolutely think PC culture can be weaponized in the same way that shitty culture can be weaponized. So anyway,
I was unsure which tangent that was going down. I held my breath then.
Well, we can come back to that. But anyway, but yeah, I think it is sort of the like, I think there is a softening of a lot of culture. And I think also that has created sort of a barbell effect. There is a backlash. There are people who think that's so frustrating and who aren't interested in that at all. But it's like that everybody talks, you know, everybody goes to therapy and it's normal and nobody judges and it's fine. And of course there are still people who judge, but like, that stand-ups say I go to therapy and nobody in the audience bats an eye is like that. That's what I mean. And when I'm saying softening, I don't mean to say weak, whatever. You get what it is. Whatever the shift is toward, it's okay to have feelings. Toward, let's look at the larger picture of what is in a person's life that affects the decisions they're making, rather than just let's villainize a person because they did a bad thing, whatever. It's all of that sort of what you could see as a cultural enlightenment. I'm a little hesitant to call it that because I don't think it's, I think it's very flawed, but that sort of baby step toward cultural enlightenment is, I think, what then sort of opens the door for a comedy to also have feelings.
I wholeheartedly agree. And
correct.
Yeah, fully endorse all of the above. And going back to Judd Apatow, I'd not made that connection before, that he not only revolutionized but sort of caused a divide, like before times and after times.
Yeah, and of course, look, somebody who knows more about the film industry than me, which is most people because I know very little. I'm sure somebody would say, no, this person was doing it before Apatow. And I'm sure somebody would say, you know, here are other people who have done it better and differently, or here are other reasons. But I think maybe the strongest argument in my case is that I, as somebody who doesn't know much about, who doesn't really watch movies and who doesn't know much about the film industry, I think the reason is Judd Apatow, which means that is a symbol of the mark that he's made.
Oh, totally. And being someone in the top of comedy yourself, if you go in with that assumption, it can only sort of become almost like a self-fulfilling prophecy that it is sort of known as that because the comedy you are creating with that knowledge is based as a truth.
Right.
So you're creating that truth, whether it was initially or not, which is not meant to, I realize that I phrased it as a select criticism. I did not mean it as that. It is merely as a sort of as that cultural standpoint. I'm very aware that I phrase things badly, which often come out as like a critic. Please do not take it as such. I am not.
You don't have to worry about it. You don't have to apologize. First of all, we should all. I mean, yeah, whatever. Don't worry about it. It's fine. It's very hard to offend me, and I think I mean that, as opposed to many people who say that and then promptly get offended. And also, I don't think. I guess to me, it's like make a comment. Comments that aren't 100% rosy do not need to be, are not insults, you know?
Yes.
And it's charmingly British of you to be like, I'm so sorry.
I'm glad and hope that is the takeaway and not, so I've just Skyped with this dick and he is
Do you think that there is any chance of anyone walking away from an interview with you and saying, I've just Skyped with this dick? Like, honestly, truly, like, intellectual honesty, do you think there is any chance?
It's a lot of, like, Protestant guilt that will lead me to...
That's funny. Well, to answer my own question, I, intellectually honest, think there is zero chance that anyone could ever walk away from an interaction with you and think, this dick. I'm sure there are many other bad things that they could think about you, but that is not it.
I'm obliged. Thank you very much.
See, now maybe I should apologize for saying that. But I'm an American, so I won't.
True. We need, if nothing more, we need to fulfill cultural stereotypes.
Great.
I mean, I've heard of the phrase Minnesota nice. This is clearly the epitome.
There it is.
There we go. There's no segue to this question, particularly of what we've just talked about. Favorite kids book that you grew up with?
Oh. It's funny, I'm like looking at the books on my shelf. I don't keep very many books, like relative to, you know, we are in worlds where everybody has a million books and it's sort of a prized possession to like have this big bookshelf that you can show off. And I'm sort of like, I'm never going to reread them, and I can get them at the library if I want, and they're very heavy to move, and I move a lot. So I'm not going to keep a lot of books. I loved a book. There's a book called Star Girl. There's a book called Star Girl is wonderful.
Okay, I've never heard of it.
It's like a sort of maybe early teens chapter book that is wonderful about an unlikely friendship.
Oh.
And I loved a bunch of. I was very into fantasy and. That's it, fantasy. you mean like younger than that? Yeah, I guess
whatever came to mind when I said that.
Yeah, let's say Stargirl.
Okay, Stargirl it is.
I also had My Teacher is an Alien, and I read that a lot. So
that rings a bell. I don't know where from. Oh no, we had a show called My Parents Are Aliens growing up here. That's where that comes from.
Ah.
That's my connection to it. So that I can probably guess the plot from the title, unless it's a wild left curve.
It's about an unlikely friendship. Yes.
Lovely.
I'm bad at favorites. I never have. I'm so bad at favorites. I don't mean this to make you feel bad. I never like favorite questions, because I'm always like, I'm on the spot, and like, give me a day to be like, what book. I think it's because I feel the need to give the correct answer, but I don't think about things in those terms very much, and so then there's an immediate conflict.
Sure, I'll just quickly edit the rest.
No, wait, tell me the next question.
No, that was actually the only favorite one. Now I'm tempted to come up with ones. Favorite late night host? Favorite Jimmy? We touched upon it before, inspirations, but either inspirations growing up or inspirations now. So maybe someone you've idolized, but someone we won't necessarily have heard of, but should hear about in the immediate future.
Okay, so inspirations growing up, Eddie Izzard was my, like, absolutely, like, above all else.
Amazing.
I have his specials memorized, like...
Cake or Death.
And I didn't know that was stand-up. Like, I didn't... That what and a lot of people might argue that it wasn't stand-up, but I think it is. But I just didn't. So when I was watching Comedy Central and was like, could I do stand-up? No, I'm not funny like that. Like, that was a conscious thought that I had. I'm not funny in this way. I don't joke like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I went, well, so I'll just never do stand-up in high school. I remember having that thought. And but I would watch Eddie Izzard and that was a different world to me. And it was like, oh, that's what I want to do. People now who everybody should hear about. A couple of my best friends in New York are Caitlin Palufo and Carmen LaGala and my boyfriend, Jeff Sheen. I think Jeff is truly, truly, I think he is the funniest working comic in New York.
Oh, wow. Is that 'cause he's in the room?
The funniest... No, I think that. I think he's... I just, like, I can't watch him without laughing. And even when I know every single... I know the eyebrow lift in the jokes. And I just think he's so, so, so talented, and I want everybody to hear of him.
Well, if you'd like to come on the show, he's more than welcome anytime.
Great, I'll tell him. Other people, oh, there's a comic named Ethan Simmons Patterson in New York. He's so funny. People like you haven't heard of, but you should. One of my, actually, maybe this is like the real answer to the who is my inspiration. This guy is one of my closest friends from Minneapolis comedy, and he is now in LA, and he is a writer for Will Smith's company. Will Smith basically farms out, they'll like write sketches for other celebrities who are trying to promote things. Anyway, and
okay.
This my friend is sort of manages that. His name is Turner Barrowman, and he isn't doing, I don't think he's doing, oh, he's doing very, very little like solo performance himself at this point, and I think he's fine with that. I hope and suspect that in the future he will be making amazing movies. But he, I like truly have in my head, you know, the WWJD bracelets, What Would Jesus Do?
Sure.
I have like WWTD, What Would Turner Do?
Wow.
In my head as like when I prayed to him. No, just in so many scenarios, he's so smart, and he's very good at divorcing himself of emotion in a scenario, and very good at looking at something very, very coolly,
yeah,
and dispassionately. In a way that to me is so smart and admirable and not harmful, but it is that he does that while maintaining the values that I admire. So when he's looking at something calculatingly, he is calculating, how do I not harm people, but just calculating, you know. He's just so, so, so smart. And I have followed his example in many confusing, intimidating, tricky situations in this industry.
Oh, amazing. That's the most effusive answer we've ever had to that question.
Oh, great. That's the person.
So it's Turner Barrowman.
Mm-hmm.
Wonderful.
His uncle is...
John Barrowman?
Yeah, that one.
Really?
Yeah. So Turner, I think, actually is a dual citizen.
Oh, of Scotland and...
Yeah?
I think John... I know he's American and Scottish, because he was in Doctor Who, and I was a nerd growing up.
Isn't Scotland the same? Isn't Scotland part of the UK until the referendum passes?
I mean, you said we didn't have a time limit. I don't think we have enough time for
Okay, great. Anyway, yes.
It is and it isn't. It is what Quebec is in Canada, Florida is for the rest of America, is sort of like it's its own separate entity.
Yes.
The bottom line is, Turner is the person who I...
Oh, sure, like. Yeah. No, but let's delve into Scottish history. Just reformat the podcast. Just right. A lot of Braveheart. And that's the only cultural reference I have.
Yeah, that's about it.
Well, I have two more questions, unless things pop up. A and B, which is, what is the best advice you received? What is the worst advice you received? It can be about anything.
Great. Just like in general? It's fun. I'm always like, the best advice I received was one time at I went to a high school speech and debate camp, which is worse than band camp. There's a competition at the end, and I made it to the final round of the competition, which at the time felt like this, you know, fucking enormous deal, and was easily the biggest deal that I had had in speech to that point. And I was in the bathroom before the round, and one of the counselors who was, this is going to be such a letdown, by the way, when I get to the country, she was a college speech competitor.
Okay.
And she was leading, you know, so she was coaching people, whatever. And I think she's probably gonna be judging. She was in the bathroom with me, and she saw me, and she said, and I was about to pop a zit, which is I like pick up my skin when I'm nervous or anxious and have forever. And so I was about to pop a zit, which is just a very like, I'm in a pressure situation and I'm about to do this. And this is just like my, you know, unconscious reaction. And she said, don't pop a zit before our final round. And that was like such a like, yeah, idiot. Don't do this thing that is obviously going to be bad. Like, don't self-sabotage. I think is the, like, wow, if I have twisted this into the, a real interesting comment. Somehow that, like, always really stuck with me. Don't pop a zit before I found out. Just, like, don't. Just don't.
Yeah, I totally get what you mean. The it seems like something that should be crocheted.
Thank you. Exactly. On a pillow. Right. It is the don't. Yeah, it's just, like, you don't have, whatever you're doing or not doing, like, you just can not do it or do it. Like, you can. Everybody, we have the, short of people who are, you know, are locked up, but it's like, you just can. Whatever. I'm a big believer in, like, short of, like, societal issues that are preventing you from moving up, you know, from that, short of socioeconomic reasons, for people who are sort of, like, in our general socioeconomic world, I'm like, you just can go to the grocery store and be fine or whatever. Stuff that I sort of live my life by is, it's never as good as you think it is, and it's never as bad as you think it is. Mm-hmm. Just, like, nothing matters as much as you think it does. And then as a twin to that, lower the stakes. Everything is, like, it's all the same. Make it matter less, because then everything will be better. The thing that you think needs to be perfect, if you say it can be very bad, suddenly it will be very good. Mm-hmm. Bad advice? In comedy, bad advice is, like, just keep being funny and eventually somebody will see you and pull you up and, like, and make you successful. And it's like, I think that's how it used to work. I think that's how it works 20 years ago, but it's not how it works anymore. That'll be it for bad advice.
Sure. Wonderful. Well, I normally end with the question, why do we need stories? But I think with such a career in speech and debate, my final question will be, why do we need rhetoric?
Well, here's my maybe annoying answer. To me, it's like, it's not a, I view rhetoric, and maybe we're using a different definition here. Sorry that you're about to get a real nerd answer to this.
Oh, no, feel free.
The way I think of rhetoric is the act of persuading, or the artifact that persuades in any, I view it as in a very liberal lens, that rhetoric exists everywhere. And so then, you know, through that lens, it's like people who say, wow, I studied informational sciences in clothes and how clothes transmit information. And to me, I'm like, well, yeah, that's rhetoric. That's what it is. It is, you know, it's like, it is transmitting information that is inherently intended to persuade, even though nobody thinks about it like that. When somebody's like, I'm going to wear an all black outfit because that's cool and I'm in New York and that's cool. Mm-hmm. Nobody's going, I am intending to persuade my desired audience that I am, elite and worth more than someone else. Nobody thinks like that, but that's what is underneath it. So that's how I think of rhetoric. And so then because of that, I think that the question of why do we need rhetoric is sort of moot, because it's irrelevant whether we need it or not. It is everywhere. It is in everything. We see it all the time. It is in every, you know, all mass media that we consume is filled with rhetoric. Everything that we read is filled with rhetoric. So then I think the question is, so it's like the one question is, what is important about rhetoric? I guess to me, I get to, why do we need rhetorical analysis? And rhetorical analysis sounds like the most fucking annoying, you know, grad school $10 word, shut the fuck up. Yes, I get that. But it's sort of, but the, you know, the plain speak is, why do we need to talk about the messages we are receiving? Because those messages are almost never organic. You know, it's not, they are shaped by someone and for someone. And, that is important to see who is shaping what we consume and what their intention is and what their, you know, what strings are they attached to. And so I think that's my question. That's my answer of, it is not, rhetoric exists. So then the question is, why do we need rhetorical analysis?
Which we'll save for the follow-up interview.
Yes, great. So I'm so sorry that that was supposed to be like some beautiful swan dive, and wow, it was just really.
No, it was wonderful. It was it was rhetorical analysis of the question of what is rhetoric.
Perfect.
It is rhetorical inception. So Chloe, where can people find you?
On Instagram, I'm chloe.radcliffe, and that's mostly where I am. I'm not really on Twitter very much.
Fantastic. Well, this has been so much fun, and I'm glad I didn't come off as a dick. That's always a positive.
Not possible.
Thank you. Well, on that note, Radcliffe, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you, Dom. This was so great. It was so fun.